Hello, and a warm welcome to the very first Respiratory Futures podcast. My name is Ruth Ellenby. I'm Head of Policy and Communications at the British Thoracic Society, and I'm delighted to be joined here at BTS head office on a dark and blustery day by Dr. Louise Restrick, Integrated Consultant Respiratory Physician from Whittington Health in North London, Professor Alf Collins, NHS England's Clinical Director for Personalised Care, and Chris Warburton, former social worker and social work manager who is living with COPD. Our guests will be talking today about shared decision-making and motivational interviewing. These are fascinating and really important topics, which we may not all know quite as much about as we perhaps ought to. And so to kick things off, each of our guests is going to tell us a little bit about what shared decision-making means to them. Over to you, Alf.
Thanks very much, Ruth. I'm Alf Collins. I'm Clinical Director for Personalised Care in NHS England. I'm a doctor by training, and I was for many years a trainer in motivational interviewing. So I sit most of my time in NHS England thinking about this stuff and supporting people to put it in place. To my mind, there are an awful lot of terms that we bandy about which actually represent pretty much the same stuff. We talk about shared decision making, we talk about motivational interviewing, we talk about health coaching, we talk about personalised care and support planning, and support for self-management. What they all encompass is a way of working that's informed by motivational interviewing. And that way of working really says, I am here to work with you, to support you, to make decisions that are right for you, and to support you, and I'm looking at Chris as I'm saying this, to live well, given the fact that you live with COPD. So that's my job, that's my role, and really all of these skills flow from that. Actually, what I would say is rather a deep understanding of our role in relation to working effectively with people who live with long-term conditions.
I'm Chris Warburton, and I'll pick up with what Alf just said. Yes, living with long-term conditions is a far greater challenge, I think, than people ever think it's going to be. It involves vast changes in your life and your lifestyle often, not just yours, but the people around you, the people who you love, the people who are caring for you. And anything that can make that simpler, anything that can make that easier, any input from the professionals that can help you through that change, assuming they understand that change, is to be very strongly welcomed. I'm confused, but personally I'm confused by all the different words that are used, as Alf said, for the same thing. But we'll sort that out as we go along, I'm sure.
So I'm Louise Restrick. I work as an integrated consultant respiratory physician, and picking up what Chris has just said, I think I ought to define the term integrated. There are a lot of words that are very used at the moment. Integrated is one of them. What integrated means to me and the team that I work in is that we aim to deliver person-centred, another well-used word, evidence-based, high-value care that feels joined up to the person experiencing it. And I think that's one of the reasons that I hope I and the team I work in have been part of a journey, and it is a journey of understanding how better to work with our patients living with their very challenging long-term conditions. And for me, with far less expertise than Alf, but again, a deeply held commitment to it, I think shared decision means a series of conversations that are part of a journey that enable a clinician to work in partnership with a patient.
The crucial point here is that each brings an original or their own sense of their being and what they are doing to that relationship. And what is the most powerful thing is when the HCP, the healthcare professional, and the patient are able to combine their two separate knowledges.
It is about, you know, culture and belief and values and what we hold. Actually, I have a four-word summary which Steve Rolnick, who's one of the fathers of motivational interviewing, shared with us, which summarises it really nicely for me, which is, I guide, you decide.
do you know what what this means to me, this conversation, is there's something about power here, and there's been quite a lot of research around power. It's not a word that we tend to bandy around very much, but I think one of the kind of core pieces for a healthcare professional is to know and acknowledge that actually we do hold a lot of power. And there is an imbalance in our relationship unless we work on it, unless we actively, consciously work on it to even out that power differential so we are indeed working on the same level. It takes work and it takes thought.
I always think about this. I cannot help think about this in my patient, as a patient. When I'm sitting there at any of the hospitals I attend in London, I go to 3 or 4, and at some hospitals, they're always running late, doesn't matter, they're always running late. And yet, when I called up one day recently from a traffic jam and said, I'm sorry, I'm going to be 10 minutes late for my appointment, you know what I got? Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Warburton, but I can't guarantee that we will see you today. And I just blew up. I mean, I didn't. I just switched the phone off. I mean, that's all I could do. But I mean, and there was this actual straightforward, clear power thing. I'm afraid, you know, I'm down there and they're up there. They can do what they like. I have to respond to that.
I think it's, both shaming and also, you know, I can identify with that.
And the other thing that you've talked about, Chris, you talked about the work of living with long-term conditions, and your face said it all as I said that. Can you tell us more about that?
I think, you know, the hardest thing is it's in the title, isn't it? It's long-term conditions. It just bloody goes on. And the only time it's going to end is when I'm in my box. And Louise and all my friends have come to say goodbye to me, but I won't be there because I'll be somewhere else. And that's the future. Now, you can make it as... you can call it by different names and ends and all the rest of it, but I mean, that's for people like me. That's the future.
And what is coming so strongly out of that description, Chris, is... You didn't use the words my COPD, my chest. You talked about you as a person. And there's something about the impact of living with long-term conditions that perhaps we don't pay enough attention to. We think about managing the long-term condition itself as well as possible. We don't pay enough attention to the impact it has on you.
It's the bit you don't really want to talk about, isn't it? It's the bit about getting ground down by it all. It's the bit about missing going to your best friend's funeral because some bit of you is not working properly and you really, really want to go. And this happens time and time again. And at the moment, I'm in conflict with my best beloved about do we book to go to things because we seem to unbook or give away tickets at a rate of knots. Now, I say to her, it doesn't matter with our friends because if they're our friends, they understand. But certainly our circle of friends diminishes, having this kind of long-term condition.
Chris has been one of a number of people who have really helped within respiratory for the voice of the experience of living with COPD to be heard. And one of the things you've taught us, as have other patients, to talk about is it's not just the functional impact of your world getting smaller, which we really have heard and is what you're describing, but there's the unpredictable aspect. And I think it is worth highlighting, listeners, if they do want to hear more, there is a very powerful video you made with the British Lung Foundation, which talks about the experience of what it's like for someone to live with COPD.
So we've talked about living with the condition. We've talked about the impact on our worlds narrowing and the effect it has on us emotionally. What does this all mean for the way in which we as healthcare professionals should work with you, Chris? What do you want? What do you perhaps now even come to expect from the healthcare professionals that you work with?
I meet colleagues from not just from London but from outside London, and I discovered that some of them, it takes 6 months to get pulmonary rehab, an appointment to start a pulmonary rehab. Here at the hospital I happen to be involved in, you get it within 3 or 4 weeks at the most, and I think that's on a bad day. You'll probably get it before then if you're lucky. And I think it's one of the most crucial things that you can have if you've got a chest like mine. It's great stuff. It does you a lot of good. And it makes people like me who don't like doing exercise, it makes me do a bit. I have a nurse who comes, a respiratory nurse, who comes every fortnight to see me now on, you know, we have an appointment to see each other. And she's got all the tools available to her. And then other colleagues from Herefordshire or Hertfordshire or Clackmannanshire or wherever, they look at me like this as if I've got two heads, or where, in which nirvana, in which heaven do I live? And I say, this is what you've got to demand. This is what you've got to demand from the people who are caring you. And you've got to go to your healthcare professionals, and you've got to go to the commissioners, and you've got to say very clearly, this is what you want. They need to hear what we have to say.
I think what you've moved in parallel from is the partnership, collaborative, clinician-patient-individual relationship into the, of course, once you're listening to patients and shaping that individual relationship, then the natural progression from that is that we co-produce and co-design services. And that's what you're so eloquently describing. So, you know, on a micro example, I think pulmonary rehabilitation is probably a really nice story. So I don't know how much Alf knows about pulmonary rehabilitation, but it is, you know, complex intervention which has a mix of conversations and physical activity in it. One of the reasons we have a psychologist in our team is one of my colleagues, Myra Stern, who I think you know, was able to set up a pilot 10 years ago where we compared the borough you live in with another borough. One borough had a psychologist working with the team who were taking on pulmonary rehab referrals, and the other team didn't. And what we found was that the psychologist working with the team was able to enable a 90% completion rate of pulmonary rehab in the borough where the psychologist worked with the team, compared to 50% in the other borough. And that translated into 9 fewer bed days, because one of the outcomes that commissioners like, and I think patients do too, because you'd rather have good days at home than bad days in hospital, is that pulmonary rehabilitation reduces hospital admissions. And of course, that's a lever for commissioning. But of course, what Sarah, our psychologist, was then able to tell us is actually you can't go to patients and shake your finger at them and say, you need to go to pulmonary rehabilitation. That isn't a motivational interviewing term approach. And so what do patients tell us about pulmonary rehab? And Chris has worked closely with a number of leading respiratory physiotherapists, who are also a really important leadership group, and Maria Buxton, who was a colleague of ours, said, well, actually, shouldn't we ask people 3 things? Do you want to breathe better? Do you want to feel good? And do you want to do more? And then instead of us lecturing patients, why don't we share feedback?
You've talked about these amazing shifts in the service. Talked about co-design, really listening. You talked about access to completion of rehab. One of the things when I go around the country talking about is I talk about this approach, motivational interviewing. I talk about what it actually means, and what it actually means in a one-to-one conversation is when you walk in the room, Chris, having gone through the kind of reason for us meeting, I'll say to you, Chris, so tell me about what you want to focus on in our time together today. And then when you say you want to focus on this, you know, we'll say, and what else do you want to talk about today, Chris? And support you to tell us what your agenda is. Oftentimes, people will come out with the agenda of the clinician as well, but sometimes they may not, and the clinician may then come in and say, and I notice you haven't mentioned smoking, is that something we should talk about today? And if you say no, that's cool. That's cool. We might say, okay, that's cool, maybe we can talk about that next time. Now, I go around the country banging on about this thing, negotiated agenda setting. It's the kind of core of motivational interviewing. I think there are some professions that just do this. The evidence is quite clear that occupational therapists, for instance, are really good at this. Broadly speaking, physiotherapists are really good at it. The evidence is also quite clear that actually doctors find it quite difficult. I think we just need to own up to that and say that that's the case. And there is a number of reasons for that. We fill our heads up with lists of evidence and guidelines, and we feel the need to get all that stuff out when we're talking with patients. I need to tell you all the evidence. That's what we think. We tend to work in a deficit model, so we tend to try and figure out what's going wrong with somebody in order to try and patch him up. And we're very solution-focused ourselves.
But that's what we ask of you.
That's what you ask of us. Absolutely.
You know, we come in and Absolutely. We say, give us a pill. You know, I've got a cerebral throat. Give us a pill. I've got to have some antibiotics. My soul.
Yeah.
You know, and...
Do you know, it's interesting you say that, Chris. There's been two big reviews of what patients, people, the public, expect of medicine broadly. One of the big reviews of patients showed that they tend to overestimate the benefits of medical treatments and underestimate the harms. There was another parallel view of clinicians, and it showed exactly the same thing. We tend to overestimate the benefits of medicine and underestimate the harms as well.
We all have still, I think, a disproportionate focus on pills, interventions. The thing about motivational interviewing for me is this is the tool, and there is a really good evidence base for it. You will know it better than I, but it's good enough for me for how you have evidence-based conversations. And evidence-based conversations have as much impact as any of the other interventions that we do.
And that's where the magic lies. It feels to me, just as you say, we feel anxious when we think patients come into us expecting more than we can give as clinicians. If we change the conversation around and instead of talking about what's wrong with you, if we start to talk about, so Chris, tell us what you can do. Tell us about a normal day. Let's have a conversation about reasonably what you'd like a good day to look like. How can we work together to try and support you to move towards having more good days than less good days? We all know that kind of slight shift in the conversation, there's magic in that. There's as much magic in that as there is in a pill.
I don't know, there's a lot of magic in that prescription pad there that you've got there. It's now printed, of course.
Using the skills of motivational interviewing makes you think about all the conversations you're having. So the conversations with colleagues, what their agendas are, what their needs are, and actually just to digress slightly, what their unmet needs are. Because working at the coalface, and this isn't making an excuse, this is just describing how it is really hard for lots of people, particularly nursing staff on the wards, particularly trainees. And one of the things that motivational interviewing does is allows you to hear what, maybe better than we would have done previously, what's being said. And also taking the one of the principles of motivational interviewing, which is affirmation. And we are really, really bad, I think, as healthcare professionals in celebrating when something has been done well. And actually, and this isn't about meaningless praise, this is about naming what behaviours or interventions were good. And there's something about celebrating even small steps. We have to keep people's hope in what they're doing and their belief in the possible when we work in such a big system that can feel like it's not changing.
And I wonder, Louise, I absolutely agree with you. For us as medics, again, we are, the first thing we do as medics is we learn pathology, one of the first things we do. So pathology is at the basis of all, it was anyway when I was at medical school, the basis of all medicine. Figure out what's gone wrong. Make a diagnosis in order that you can find something to fix it, at least in part. So we do tend to drift to that language of deficit. We do tend to look for what's going wrong. And motivational interviewing does invite us to look in the opposite direction and, just as you say, celebrate what's going well, to take a less deficit and more strengths-based approach. So, you know, as an example, you know, what we often do in the questionnaires we ask patients is tell them, is ask them to tell us exactly what they can't do, rather than use questionnaires so they can tell us what they can do. Isn't that astonishing?
And, you know, this doesn't apply to Chris because we didn't meet until long after you'd treated your tobacco dependence yourself. But I think nowhere do I hear this more strongly than when we work with people we look after who are tobacco dependent. So the first thing we've done is change the language. We don't talk about smokers and smoking cessation and a lifestyle choice because we know this is an addiction. It's an addiction to tobacco. We know we have the tools to treat addiction. They're evidence-based. And guess what? It's a combination of medication, which largely we haven't used because it's belonged for some bizarre reason to smoking cessation clinics, even though it's in the BNF and it's not difficult to prescribe, and behaviour change, which of course motivational interviewing is the strongest tool of that. And I talked a bit earlier about the shame that, you know, there isn't a single person with COPD who I look after who wouldn't like not to smoke. And we know that 40% of people admitted to hospital with COPD remain tobacco dependent. That's not because they're stupid. It's not because they've not tried before. They have tried before. This is really hard. But actually, when you talk to most people who are current smokers, and it's making them ill, so they're sick smokers, they've got COPD or ischemic heart disease, they've tried before. And they've succeeded before. But then they've relapsed because this is a relapsing, remitting, long-term condition that starts in childhood. And you then start talking about, so that's amazing. How did you stop for 6 months? What did you do then? And you then find out about the terrible thing that happened at the six-month point. Somebody they cared about a lot died. They went to a funeral. They lit up and then they relapsed. And then you start, change talk is about building on what people have done that's worked well and then using that again. But it's a completely, feels artificial the first time you do it, and then it just comes naturally. And you just see, or I just see, people thinking about what they've done in a completely different way, which makes me think we've never done that with them before. And it's shocking and shaming on us that we've allowed them to feel shame for so long.
I just wanted to add there, you used that example of somebody who might have lit up at a funeral. And we talk about affirmation. I'm going to use some jargon. We talk about affirmation, you know, celebrating success. We will also talk about normalisation. Why would you not do that? Why would you not do that? Why would you not light up at a friend's funeral? You know? But Chris, could I take us back to the conversation we had 5 or 10 minutes ago about, we talked about the magic of the conversation, and you said, well, yeah, sometimes pills can be magical as well. And I just wonder if we could talk more about that, because I did mention the fact that both the public and healthcare professionals have rather more of an expectation of medicine than it's able to deliver, and actually tend to underestimate the harms of medicine, and it gets to me into more of what a shared decision making conversation is. I'm going to use a bit of jargon, and I'm going to come to you for some thoughts, because a shared decision making conversation is informed by the principles of motivational interviewing, unconditional positive regard, normalization. I'm here to work with you and to support you to make a great decision here, Chris. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to be really honest about the options that we have available and what we know about the pros and the cons. And then I'm going to support you to make a decision. And yeah, here are the choices that we have to consider together. Let's figure out between us what the best choice for you is going to be. We would then have a talk about those options, those choices, and what we know about the pros and the cons. Now, for me, that's a kind of it's informed by motivational interviewing, but it's quite a specific conversation about treatment or care or support options. And it starts to help people understand not just the benefits of medication, but also perhaps sometimes the downsides. And it's an honest, honest conversation. You've listened. What are your responses?
You shouldn't have to say to me, I'll be really honest with you. Sorry, that if I come to a doctor and if I come and see Louise and she says, I'll be really honest with you, Chris. Yeah. I'd be like saying, well, what so-and-so have you been doing with me for the last 12 months or 12 years?
So let's just put
so let's leave that to one side.
The reason I said that...
was to wind me up.
Well, the reason I said that is that the evidence is that currently we don't necessarily tell people what the pros and the cons of the various choices available to them are.
There are two things that rang home for me. The first is, again, it's a subtle change, but it is transformative asking permission. Would you like me to tell you what I know or what I think? And asking that before talking about it. And the other thing is, picking up what you were saying about normalising, it is so helpful to normalise that people aren't taking their medication, so particularly in respiratory, thinking about inhalers, and then giving permission to people to explore what they believe about their condition. I think on average it takes a year for someone with a new diagnosis of asthma to actually believe they have asthma, for instance. You only know that by having heard people. You know, you can't even get onto a conversation about will you take your treatment if you don't believe you have the condition. And we only know that from listening to people and then normalising it. So I would say, you know, on average, people who we've diagnosed would say it takes a year to believe. Do you believe? And the number of times people don't. So that is really helpful before you even get onto the medicines. And the normalising that people aren't taking, which we know... And actually, that speaks volumes. That's the actions of what someone really thinks of what you're telling them. And that's almost the starting point.
You mean like most people... I know most people don't take most of their medicines most of the times, but how are you doing on it? You mean that kind of...
Yeah, that's the assuming honesty. That's the starting point.
That's the honesty.
Yeah.
Right.
I was trying to find out what was going to happen to me because I was, you know, at the end, I mean, what's really going to happen? And I was talking to this consultant and I said, so how long have I got to go? I mean, tell me, how long have I got to go? I'm trying to sort out my life. And he said, it's fine for 7 years or so, at least, Chris, fine for 7 years. So I said, and then what happens? And he said, oh, we'll talk about that later. Okay, so I allowed myself to be fobbed off. And I was... talking a few years later, I was talking to another very eminent consultant from one of those hospitals in South London who was on a committee that I was on, and I asked him the same question. And he said, oh, about 7 years, Chris. I thought that's interesting. And about 3 or 4 years later, I was talking to my beloved GP who was then leaving, and I was very sorry, a young man, but I actually found a young GP, and he was fabulous. And I asked him, and he said, oh, about 7 years, Chris. And I just burst out to him. I said, Tom, you guys, you're outrageous. I mean, he's only 35. He wasn't. He had no grey hairs. And I said, Tom, this is outrageous. All you lot will ever tell me is that I've got 7 years to survive, which is not the question I'm actually trying to ask you. It's kind of, that is a... trying to get into talking about what actually happens. Is it going to be nasty? Is it going to be brutish? Is it going to be awful? Can it be reasonably calm? And am I going to be ill for, you know, 6 months? Or, I mean, am I going to be properly sick, as it were, for kind of a year or 2 years, you know, until it happens? That's what I want to talk about. He says, yeah, we'll talk about that soon, Chris, don't worry. So I started talking to, I had a very nice young man provided by the hospital, who was a physio, great, respiratory physio. He was a lovely young Irishman. He was terrific. But I couldn't get him to talk about what was going to happen at the end of my life, how it might work. And then I had a lovely bouncy lady. She was terrific. I loved her with all my heart. And she didn't want to talk about what was going to happen. And then finally, a combination of my GP and my existing consultant, and we began to actually to get down to some of the basics. We've still got a way to go. But it's such a job, nobody wants to talk to you about it, it seems to me. Nobody wanted to talk to me about it.
So I think, again, this is, you know, really powerful to hear. It plays into a lot of the literature. There's a lot of discussion about palliative care, so another name that's not a useful name because people think that's about end-of-life care and hospice care, and actually it's about addressing difficult symptoms and having conversations, complex conversations about the future, where actually the principles are all about motivational interviewing. But one of the learnings from that is that, and I think there are a few things within this, that actually quite often it can be frightening for clinicians to have those conversations. We did some really interesting work with a group of respiratory registrars at a training day, again with our psychologist, and discovered that they didn't like to ask people about breathlessness because they felt they were opening a hornet's nest of something they couldn't solve. And those kind of end of what's going to happen conversations are a bit like that. You feel you're opening something you can't fix. I think that's one of the issues. The second issue, which you know, Alf has slightly talked about, is we need to be more open about saying what we don't know. And actually, we need to be really humble about it. There is no tool to predict outcome in COPD. We know what some of the factors are. And therefore, and I think we've used these terms of having a plan A and a plan B. Because of the unpredictability, and that's why you need to be humble, there are patients I've thought would live for years. In fact, we had one very upsetting, unexpected death this week. There are patients who you think are going to die. And this is the world of long-term conditions rather than cancer.
And
they're alive 5 years later. Yes, I was presenting another lady yesterday at a meeting who we first diagnosed in 2006. From all of the measures of predicting her death, she shouldn't have died in 2019, which is when she did. And then that means that you're into plan A and plan B territory. And your plan B is a plan for the worst. And one of the things that we're scared about quite often is talking about death.
We
repeatedly use the term passed away as health professionals. So this is language, we need to name it. I think we have a responsibility for people with a condition where we've even thought you might die to offer that conversation, but that's an offer to that person and their family, so that there is a plan B, so we know what people's wishes would be. Would you want to be at home? Would you want to go to intensive care? Would you want to use a non-invasive ventilation? Have we showed you non-invasive ventilation? Because we think there's a chance you might need it. And then when we've parked that planning for the worst, we need to come back into motivational interviewing land, which is hoping for the best, which is back to what would good days look like for you? What are the things you want to make happen so that your world is as big as possible from someone who's lived in a big world? And how do we make day by day each of those days feel more worth engaging with as someone who has COPD? But there is hard stuff within there, and I think we should acknowledge how scary and unsettling that is for clinicians too.
I just want to really reinforce that the evidence across all long-term conditions is really clear that the conversations we have with people living with long-term conditions are suffused by anxiety on both behalves. People living with long-term conditions are anxious.
Yeah, but you are shamans, you are magicians, you're the men and ladies, you know, with the tools. We don't have the tools. I don't have this prescription pad next to my desk, unfortunately.
And what you do have is a deep understanding of your own world, your own preferences, your own values, your own assets, your own resources. And it's only by bringing those two pieces of expertise together
can we come up with a way forward.
Exactly.
It's my understanding of myself,
exactly.
Which I'm quite fortunate. I think I do understand a bit about myself. And your understanding about how my body works that I don't have. I don't know whether it's the left ventricle or the right ventricle or any of those kind of complicated things. But put those together on level ground.
Exactly.
And you have a really strong platform.
Yeah. I want to come back to your, you know, kind of shaman. And I'm going to use the word metaphor because it felt like a distinct challenge and metaphor. And my sense is we agree about many things in this conversation. My sense is that to truly transform the way we work with people, it is about having those honest conversations. It is about the power of medication, because it can be really life-enhancing. For some people with some conditions, it can shift stuff just like that. Medication has got a very distinct role. And alongside that medical stuff, to my mind, it is about having conversations with people in partnership. We have our assets, the prescription pad. You have your assets, your ability to reach within yourself, to problem solve yourself, to work with your family and the carers and the people around you, to live as life as fruitfully as you possibly can. And I think that's where we agree. It's that coming together of those assets and resources.
Yeah, that's exactly
at the heart of all this.
What worries me slightly is, I mean, if you demystify yourselves too much, how much of the magic do we lose?
And I guess my just gentle challenge back would be to say that my understanding, I think what you're saying is talking about the power of placebo effect. And the power of placebo effect is really profound. And there's quite a lot of evidence now from colleagues in Oxford that are showing us that actually it's empathy that's at the core of the placebo effect. And what we're talking about here is empathetic conversations.
I just know that there's, you know, I don't know, 90% or 95% of patients who won't talk to their doctors about any of these issues. I'm afraid so, guys. And one reason why I got very involved in it is because I'm silly enough or stupid enough to open my big mouth quite wide and say what I've got to say, because I'm at an age where I don't care. I've got no ego left or anything like that. I mean, it's just the way it is. And so I represent a lot of people who can't do that. And I think you guys are picking, you know, gradually, as you say, with these new movements at all, at the moment, you're picking up on these things. And I think that's very, very important. But you also need to train your patients.